Well, let's turn, please, in our Bibles to Psalm 139, the book of Psalms, the 139th Psalm. Follow along as I read Psalm 139, beginning at verse 1. O Lord, Thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest my downsitting and mine uprising. Thou understandest my thoughts afar off. Thou compassest my path and my lying down, and art acquainted with all my ways. For there is not a word in my tongue, but lo, O Lord, Thou knowest it altogether. Thou hast beset me behind and before, and laid Thine hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain unto it. Whither shall I go from Thy Spirit? Or whither shall I flee from Thy presence? If I ascend up into heaven, Thou art there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, Thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there shall Thy hand lead me, and Thy right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, even the night shall be light about me. Yea, the darkness hideth not from Thee, but the night shineth as the day. The darkness and the light are both alike to Thee. For Thou hast possessed my reins, Thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise Thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are Thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. My substance was not hid from Thee when I was made in secret and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect. And in Thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned, when as yet there was none of them. How precious also are Thy thoughts unto me, O God! How great is the sum of them! If I should count them, they are more in number than the sand. When I awake, I am still with Thee. Surely Thou wilt slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me, therefore, you bloody men. For they speak against Thee wickedly, and Thine enemies take Thy name in vain. Do not I hate them, O Lord, that hate Thee? And am not I grieved with those that rise up against Thee? I hate them with perfect hatred. I count them mine enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me, and know my thoughts, and see if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. Psalm 139 is a very special psalm because, above all else, this psalm is a psalm specifically about God. Many of the psalms, the psalmist writes about himself. And while the psalmist certainly refers to himself, he only does so to the extent that is necessary to speak about God. And so this psalm is a grand revelation of God's glory in the area of His being and in the area of His power, like no other passage reveals Him. This passage is the largest and the clearest declaration of the omniscience of God and the omnipresence of God and the omnipotence of God that we find anywhere in the entire book of Psalms. And it does not make that revelation of God's omniscience and omnipresence and omnipotence in some abstract and academic fashion. Rather, this psalm reveals God's character and nature through the personal experience of the psalmist. as he comes to an overwhelming awareness of who God really is in relationship to himself as an individual. This psalm throbs with deep emotion and with an awestruck awareness of who God is to the psalmist as he meditates on his nature and his being. And the more he thinks about who God is and who God is to him, the more he is lost in wonder and love and praise. And so this is no mere dry academic theological discourse about the nature and the attributes of God. Theological truth about God was never meant to be a dry academic study that had no real relevance to our lives, but was merely in the realm of philosophical speculation. Instead, who God is and what God has done in the consideration of his nature and his character and his attributes should have a profound effect on our feelings, on our outlook, on our lives, and on our attitudes. God's identity and God's attributes and God's activities should affect us personally at the very core of our being. It should affect us at an extremely personal level and in such a way that impacts our everyday life at the deepest level and to the greatest degree. The psalmist doesn't just talk philosophically about God with no connection with himself, but rather as he talks about God, he talks about God in terms of his personal experience with that God. So the psalmist did not see God as some abstract, distant deity who is a mere concept of the mind, but rather he saw him as a present companion. He saw him as an all-knowing Lord. He saw him as a powerful and wise personal creator who made him individually to be who he was and then who directed him in his life in all of his steps. And so this is an intensely personal revelation of God as God intersects with the life of the believer. Such a God is one with whom we can have a profound personal relationship and a deep personal walk. He is a God who is near. He is not a God who is afar off. And so what we want to do together this evening is to examine this personal God with whom the psalmist had such a personal relationship. And as we consider these transcendent, exalted attributes of God, understand the intensely personal and immediate impact that they have on our lives and on our relationship with that high and lofty one who inhabits eternity. So in the first place then this evening, let us consider together the revelation of God's omniscience. The revelation of God's omniscience. Now, the revelation of God's omniscience is contained in verses 1 through 6. God's omniscience, of course, speaks of his infinite knowledge of all things actual and all things possible, so that there is nothing that is outside of the realm of God's knowledge. And so the psalmist opens his prayer in Psalm 139. He opens his prayer to God with a reflection on the perfect knowledge that God has of him. Notice, if you will, verse 1. He says, O Lord, thou hast searched me and known me. And what he's saying here in verse 1 is that God has thoroughly investigated and entirely explored and fully examined and completely gone over all that the psalmist is. And therefore, he fully knows him in every detail of his thoughts. in every detail of his motives, in every detail of his character, and in every detail of his conduct. There is not a speck of who the psalmist is or what he does that God does not thoroughly and exhaustively know. Nothing remains hidden from God. God knows every detail of everything that we are and that we do. Nothing escapes his notice. All is open to him, and everything about us is fully understood by him. The psalmist makes this clear by citing specific examples in his own life of the depth and the degree to which God knows everything about him. Notice verse 2. Thou knowest my downsitting and mine uprising. Thou understandest my thoughts afar off. And so what is being said in verse 2 is that whatever outward physical activity we may engage in, whether it is more passive, like sitting down, or whether it is more active, like standing up, God is always instantly aware of what we are doing. Furthermore, whatever inward mental thoughts we are engaging in, God knows all of them, however fleeting they may be. He understands our thoughts afar off. That is, even before our thoughts are fully formed in our own minds, God already knows what they are, what they're going to be, and where they're going to go. And so our most secret and even incipient thoughts cannot be hidden from God. And so verse 2 says, whatever outward physical activity we may engage in, whatever inward mental thoughts we may engage in, God knows all that we do externally, he knows all that we think internally, and he knows them to a degree and to a depth that is even greater than we ourselves know them. Now notice, if you will, verse 3. Thou compassest my path and my lying down, and art acquainted with all my ways. Now, the psalmist not only sits down and stands up and thinks, he also travels. And verse 3 is saying, whatever journeys, whatever path the psalmist walks on or takes, the Lord knows what they are, and he knows where he went. God knows when he stops along the way to lie down and rest. And so the Lord knows his path that he walks on, and when he stops to lie down, the Lord knows about that as well. The Lord is intimately acquainted with all the travels he takes and with all that occurs during those journeys as he takes them. Now, men may not know where the psalmist goes or what happens along the way during his journey, but God does know, and God knows every detail of it. Verse 4 goes on to say, for there is not a word in my tongue, but, O Lord, thou knowest it altogether. And so God knows every word that the psalmist speaks, no matter how quietly he expresses it, no matter to whom he speaks it. God knows it, remembers it, and responds to it. There is nothing he says that God does not hear. And now verse 5. Thou hast beset me behind and before, and laid thine hand upon me. And what he is saying here is that God is so close to him that it is as though God is behind him and in front of him at the same time. That God is so close to him at all times that God is, as it were, within arm's reach, close enough to lay his hand on him at any point in time, no matter where he is or where he turns. And so nothing in his life can escape the knowledge and the eye of one who is so close to him. And so whatever outward physical activity he engages in, whether passive or active, whatever inward mental thoughts he has, whether fully developed or merely incipient, whatever journeys the psalmist takes, whatever path he goes on, whatever happens during that journey, whatever words come out of the psalmist's mouth, when he turns, God is in front of him, and when he turns again, God is behind him. All of this comprises his personal, felt understanding of the degree to which God knows him. Now, verse 6 says, such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain unto it. And so the psalmist is overwhelmed, and the psalmist is awestruck at the knowledge that God has of him. The knowledge God has of him is complete and perfect, and it comprehends all that occurs inwardly in his mind and outwardly in his words and actions, and completely in his circumstances as he travels through life. It's a source of amazement and wonder that God has this perfect knowledge of him. God's knowledge is complete in all aspects and in every detail, and the fact of the matter is God knows him better than he knows himself. That's the degree of the knowledge that God has of his child. And so we see then the revelation of God's omniscience. You know, people may misjudge what we think, what we say, what we do, where we go, but God never does. He perfectly knows all things about us. Well, that brings us then to our second major point. Having seen the revelation of God's omniscience, notice secondly, the revelation of God's omnipresence. The revelation of God's omnipresence. Now, this is in verses 7 to 12. Now, one of the reasons why God is omniscient, that is, all-knowing, is because God is omnipresent, that is, he is present everywhere with the totality of his being and the entirety of his attention at the same time everywhere in the universe. That is, there is no place he is not. There is no place he is not with the totality of his being and his attention. And there is no place he is not with the totality of his being and his attention at the same time throughout the universe. That's what it means to be omnipresent. Now, you are not. You are here in this room, and that means you're not at home. But God is equally at your house as he is here, as he is in New Jersey, as he is in China. There is no place that God is not. And so, as we said, one of the reasons for God's omniscience is God's omnipresence. God knows all things because he is present everywhere, so that nothing can be done outside his observation or done, as it were, behind his back so that he doesn't notice. All things are open before the eyes of him with whom we have to do because he is everywhere at all times to observe it and is never distracted by having his attention elsewhere. Now notice, if you will, verse 7. He says, asking a rhetorical question, whither shall I go from thy spirit? Or whither shall I flee from thy presence? Now, the psalmist is not desiring or contemplating trying to escape from the presence of God. That isn't what this question is about. He's not here, sitting here saying, now let's see, how can I get away from God? That's not what the intent of the question is. The psalmist is not desiring or contemplating trying to escape from the presence of God when he asks this question in verse 7. That is the last thing he wants to do. For the psalmist, and indeed for every believer, the presence of God with him is the greatest possible source of comfort. And this is why Jesus said, "Lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the world." That wasn't a threat. That was a promise of comfort. What the psalmist is doing in verse 7 when he asks this question, "Where shall I go from thy spirit, or where shall I flee from thy presence?" What he is doing is he is engaging in what we call a thought experiment. That is, he is visualizing various situations in which he might find himself. And then in each of those situations, he is asking himself if that might be a situation or a place where the comforting and reassuring presence of God with him might be absent. And he thankfully realizes as he goes through each possible scenario and situation that in none of those scenarios, in none of those situations, in none of those places, could he ever be separated from the presence of God. And that's good news. Now notice, if you will, verse 8. Here's the first scenario. He says, "If I ascend up into heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, thou art there." So in this thought experiment that the psalmist is doing, the first possibility he considers are the extremes of height and depth. Now the terms heaven and hell may be taken literally, because even in those realms, God's presence exists. God's presence certainly is in heaven, and it's certainly in hell. But it's unlikely that he's talking about literal hell. The word here is Sheol. It could also be translated as a low place, and heaven understood as being a high place. It's more likely that he's thinking here about the highest and the lowest places on earth that he might find himself. Whether one ascends to the top of the highest mountain, or whether one descends to the bottom of the lowest valley, is he ever going to go in height or depth to find a place where God isn't? And the answer is, no, he won't. God is fully there with all of his being. So on the top of Mount Everest, or in the bottom of the Marianas Trench, the highest and lowest places on earth, God is there. Now notice verses 9 and 10. He says, "If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost part of the sea, even there shall thy hand lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me." Having considered the possibility of height and depth, he now considers the possibility of near and far. And so whether he remains where he is, or if somehow he's able to fly to the most distant edge of the world on the rays of the dawning light of the sun, God would still be with him. No matter how far he travels horizontally across the world, if he goes as far across the world as the sun rays reach, he can never travel away from the presence of God. Wherever he goes in his travels, the comforting, guiding, protecting hand of God is upon him and with him there. Now, the marvel of God's presence does not repel or frighten the psalmist. Instead, it brings him to a sense of security and safety and support to know that God's right hand, his most skilled and his most powerful hand, is there upon him for good. And so he says in verse 10, "Even there shall thy hand lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me." And far from being a source of terror, that is a source of comfort to know that when you're in a strange place, God's holding your hand. And he's holding your hand, not with his left hand, but with his right hand, his best hand. Now the thought experiment proceeds in verses 11 and 12. He says, "If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, even the night shall be light about me. Yea, the darkness hideth not from thee, but the night shineth as the day. The darkness and the light are both alike to thee." So having considered the possibility of height and depth and the possibility of near and far, he finally considers the possibility of darkness and light. Now, it's expected that God would be able to track us and follow us in the light because we're able to do that. We can follow and keep up with people that we can see when it's daylight. But what about when it's dark? How many times have you been with someone in the dark and lost track of each other and suddenly they're gone and you don't know where they are and you're not with them anymore and they're not with you? Might God in the dark lose track of where I'm at? Might I wander away from his presence in the dark of night and he would not be with me again? Well, the answer clearly is once again, no. God does not need light to see like we do. He can see us and keep track of us and stay beside us equally well if it is day or if it is night. God can see as well at night as he can in the day, and therefore we have no fear that we might become hidden from his presence in the darkness. The thickest gloom in the darkest cave is no barrier to God's ability to see us and to remain with us. And so the psalmist says, you know, it doesn't matter how high in this world I go or how low. It doesn't matter how near or how far. It doesn't matter if it's in the daylight or if it's in the dark. Nothing can separate me from the presence of God. His comforting, protecting, guiding presence that he has promised to me and that he gives to me as the source of my greatest comfort. Well, that brings us then to the third revelation of God. We've seen the revelation of God's omniscience in verses 1 to 6. God searches us and thoroughly knows us and everything about us and everything we say and do and think and everywhere we go. We've seen the revelation of God's omnipresence, whether high or low, whether near or far, whether light or dark, God is always with us. Now notice thirdly the revelation of God's omnipotence. The revelation of God's omnipotence. Now this is in verses 13 to 18. God's omniscience is the fact that he knows everything. God's omnipresence is the fact that he is always everywhere at the same time with the totality of his being. And God's omnipotence speaks of the fact that he is all-powerful and there is nothing that is too hard for him or beyond his ability to do. And so in verses 13 to 18, the psalmist moves from a contemplation of the knowledge of God and the presence of God to a contemplation now of the power of God. Now the power of God is manifest in many places, and the power of God is manifested in many ways, but nowhere is the power of God more manifested in a greater way than in the fashioning of the human body and the human soul, which are the pinnacle of God's creative work here on earth when He made us in His image. When you think of all that God has made, whether it's the stars, or whether it's the sun or the moon, or whether it's the seas, or the land, or the animals, or the trees, the greatest creation of them all, and the greatest manifestation of the power of God among them all, is the creation of man. The human body and the human soul are the highest creative act of God on this earth, and therefore in them is seen the greatest display of the power of God here on earth in the realm of creation. And so in verse 13, he says, "For thou hast possessed my reins. Thou hast covered me in my mother's womb." And what he is saying here in verse 13 is that God formed the innermost part of our being by His power, and therefore He possesses control of the innermost parts of our being and the construction of all of its parts. God was the one who, as it were, wove together all the sinews and the muscles and the organs and the bones and the blood vessels and the nerves to make the whole of who we are while we were still in our mother's womb. Now imagine the amazing wisdom and skill and power that it must take to create a complete human being in the womb of its mother. Such power is beyond all of our comprehension. We could not make one cell, much less the billions and billions necessary to make up a human being. And then to make all the right kinds of cells, such as muscle cells and nerve cells and bone cells, and then place them all in the proper relationship with each other and weave them together and attach them to each other in all the right spots so that they all function in harmony with each other. The whole project overwhelms the mind just to think about it, much less to be able to do it. And yet God has done it, and He has done it billions of times. Verse 14, "I will praise Thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are Thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well." And so this contemplation he's engaging in of the power of God to make His body moves the psalmist to burst forth in praise for the awe-inspiring and wonderful work that God has done. He says in verse 14 that his soul is profoundly moved, and well it should be, at the marvel of God's creative power. His soul knows that it was a marvelous work that God did when He made him in the wonderful and awe-inspiring fashion in which He did. Now notice verses 15 and 16. He says, "My substance was not hid from Thee when I was made in secret, and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect. And in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned, when as yet there was none of them." Now, in verse 15, he talks about being curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. And this phrase, the lowest parts of the earth, may indeed be a reference to the female womb. It may also be a reference, and I think probably more likely, that it's a reference to the time when God made Adam. And you remember that God made Adam out of the lowest parts of the earth. That is, he used the dust. Now, there were some better things God could have used. He could have started with the plants. They were somewhat advanced. Or he could have used one of the animals. They were really advanced and started and leveraged off the animal and made the man. But no, he didn't start with the animal. He didn't start with the plants. He started with the very lowest materials that were available. The dust of the earth, and out of it, he made mankind. And the same skill that made Adam from the dust of the earth, from the lowest parts of the earth, is the same skill that made us in the womb of our mothers. Our formation in our mother's womb was secret. That is, it was veiled from the eyes of men. Couldn't see what was going on in there. But it was not veiled from the eyes of God. God's eyes saw the division of every cell. God's hand guided the formation of every part. And God didn't just do this randomly. God had a master plan made up for each of us before he made us. A blueprint, if you will. And when he did make us in our mother's womb, he made us according to that exact plan and blueprint. We were not made by accident. We were not the result of random genetic combinations. Rather, we're made according to God's perfect plan. And all we are by God's design. Our height, our appearance, our characteristics, our gender, our genetic makeup, all of that was planned by God before it was ever begun and executed and carried out by God in his marvelous creative work in the womb. Notice, if you will, verses 17 and 18. He says, "How precious also are thy thoughts unto me, O God! How great is the sum of them! If I should count them, they are more in number than the sand. When I awake, I am still with thee." All of this contemplation of God's power and God's wisdom in making him was simply overwhelming to him. That God would think on him enough to plan for him and then create him in his mother's womb according to that plan. That this great sum of God's thoughts were focused on him. And how he would fit into all God planned and purposed in this world. That was just simply overwhelming to him. It was beyond his ability to comprehend or to wrap his mind around. God's thoughts toward us are overwhelming in their number. They are overwhelming in their complexity. They are overwhelming in their depth. They are overwhelming in their greatness and they are overwhelming in their wisdom. That God, the infinite God, would think that much and to that degree and in that detail about you so as to design every molecule in your body, arrange them into exactly who you are, and then plan the entire universe out in the flow of his providence for you to fit perfectly into it, being the person who he made you to be for that situation. We could never exhaust or reach the end of the thoughts of God toward us any more than we could count the grains of sand on the beach. He says in verse 18, "If I could count them, they are more in number than the sand." And when we have exhausted our minds trying to comprehend all God is and all God does in His power, we fall asleep. And when we wake up in the morning, all the wonder is still there. And the presence of God is still with us. And the knowledge God has of us is still exhaustively perfect and complete. This wonder that the psalmist is experiencing here as he thinks about the omniscience of God and the omnipresence of God and the omnipotence of God isn't something that, well, next week it won't seem quite so great. No, every morning when he wakes up, he is overwhelmed all over again with the greatness of the infinity of God. And so God overwhelms us every day with his knowledge, with his presence, and with his power. And all we can do is wonder and worship as we contemplate all that he is and all that he does in relationship to us. Now let me ask you, is this dry theology? No. No, there's nothing dry about theology. It is as personal as the innermost thought that you have. It is as wonderful as the complexity of your body. It is as all-comprehending as the totality of your life experiences. God is woven into everything you are and everything you do and everything you think and everything you experience and all that unfolds in your life. He is infinitely close. He is always present. And he is limitlessly powerful, not only to make you, but to sustain you and to guide you with his right hand as he stands behind you and before you, leading you in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. That's a friend and a companion. Well, that leads us to our fourth and final major point. Having seen the revelation of God's omniscience, in verses 1 to 6, having seen the revelation of God's omnipresence, in verses 7 to 12, having seen the revelation of God's omnipotence, in verses 13 to 18, now we come to the revelation of God's justice in verses 19 to 24. I'd like to just read verses 19 to 24 now. It says in verse 19, "Surely thou wilt slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me, therefore, you bloody men. For they speak against thee wickedly, and thine enemies take thy name in vain. Do not I hate them, O Lord, that hate thee? And am not I grieved with those that rise up against thee? I hate them with a perfect hatred. I count them mine enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. And see if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." Now, verses 19 to 24, which I just read to you, may seem like a rather abrupt change of thought from what we've previously been reflecting on. The omniscience of God, the omnipresence of God, the omnipotence of God. The psalm could have easily ended at verse 18. But it didn't. And as we come now to verses 19 to 24, we think, wow, that's abrupt. That's a strange switch. But really it isn't. Really the thoughts of verses 19 to 24 flow quite naturally from what has gone on before. Because as the psalmist has contemplated the wonder of who God is in his knowledge and his presence and his power, he is suddenly struck with horror at the thought that some human might dare to reject and rebel against such a God as this. It is a grossly evil and criminal act to hate and blaspheme such an omniscient, omnipresent, omnipotent God who is high, who is holy, who is all-knowing, who is all-present, and who is all-powerful. And therefore the psalmist recoils in horror that some would blaspheme and hate such a God as this. And he expects that God will quickly and righteously destroy such evil men who would reject and hate such a wonderful God. The psalmist not only expects that God will destroy these wicked people, but he also very quickly aligns himself with God and takes the side of God against those people as well. Having seen the wonder of God, he cannot tolerate those who would turn against such a God and finds himself revolted by them. Such people deserve to be destroyed by God. And the psalmist prays that God would do so. I mean, it would be kind of like you have a soldier on the battlefield, and through vast heroics and self-sacrifice, he winds up saving a number of his buddies from certain death. And his valor and courage and selflessness is recognized. He's brought before the commanding officer of the armies of the United States, and he's given the Medal of Honor. And everybody is standing in awe of what this person has done. And then somebody comes up and starts mocking this soldier and casting slander and aspersion and foul names on him. How do you think you would react? You would immediately leap to the defense of this Medal of Honor winner who had so sacrificed himself for the lives of others, and you would be angry, and you would confront, and you would push away and repudiate anyone who would criticize him for who he was and what he had done. And you would be horrified that someone would mock and slander such a one who had done such a mighty act. Now, if that's true in the human realm, that we would leap to the defense of such an honorable person, how much more in the divine realm? Here is God, omniscient, omnipresent, omnipotent, who has done things that are beyond human comprehension in terms of the wonder and value of them. And somebody's going to come and attack him? Are we going to leap to his defense? Are we going to turn against the one who would attack such a wonderful person? And would we strive to see him silenced? That's what's going on here in this passage. Notice verse 19. Surely thou wilt slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me, therefore, you bloody men, for they speak against thee, God, wickedly, and thy enemies take thy name, that is God's name, in vain. Now, does God deserve to have his name taken in vain? Has he done anything that makes him worthy of having his name blasphemed? Has God done anything that would deserve people speaking wickedly against him? Here in 19, verse 19, these men are described as wicked and bloodthirsty. And in verse 20, we see their blasphemy against God and their abuse of God's name. Such renders them worthy of judgment. And so the psalmist says in verse 19, surely you will slay such people. Now, in verses 21 and 22, the psalmist now expresses his loyalty to God. Notice, he says in verse 21, do not I hate them, O Lord, that hate thee? And am not I grieved with those that rise up against thee? I hate them with a perfect hatred. I count them my enemies. Now, what the psalmist is doing in verses 21 and 22 is expressing his loyalty to God. And he's taking God's side against those who hate God. Here you are. You're walking across the parking lot with your wife. And some person comes up and starts abusing your wife. How are you going to feel towards them? Well, if you're loyal to your wife at all, you're going to instantly jump to her side, jump to her defense, and begin assaulting those who are assaulting her. Right? And that's all the psalmist is doing. These people are assaulting God. And so the psalmist says, I want to assault them for assaulting my God. And so he's taking God's side against those who hate God. And the point is this. Here's the point. To the extent that men oppose God, to that extent we must oppose them. I'll say that again. To the extent that men oppose God, to that extent we must oppose them. Loyalty to God demands nothing less. When someone sets themselves against God, then I set myself against them. Now, this doesn't mean I'm going to go shoot them or stab them or beat them up physically. But it does mean I'm going to use the legitimate weapons of warfare that God has given me to do all within my power to oppose them in every way that I can out of loyalty to the God that I love. Just as I would oppose anyone who would assault my wife, I would oppose anyone who would assault my God. So, why does the psalmist hate these people? Because they hate God. It's not like he went and found some innocent person, right, and says, you know, I hate you. No. He's simply repaying to these people what they are doing to God. You know, I don't just walk up to some random person and punch him in the nose. But if that person punches my wife in the nose, I'm going to punch them in the nose, right? Okay? You're going to react to them in the way in which they have reacted to God. They started the fight. You're going to finish it. And so the psalmist didn't start out hating. No, the wicked started the hatred, and he just gave them back what they began with. Now, verse 23 and 24. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts, and see if there be any wicked way in me. And lead me in the way everlasting. Now, understand in verses 23 and 24, the psalmist, in condemning others for their sins, does not think he himself is therefore sinless. He is acutely aware that even in his anger against the enemies of God, he may be falling into unconscious sins himself. And so he asks God to show him if he is. He does not presume on his own righteousness. He has a healthy self-distrust. And so while he is outraged at the evil of others, he is not unaware of the evil in his own heart. And therefore, he's not proud. And so he closes with this wonderful prayer. May the Lord who sees all search me, go over every detail of who I am, and then reveal to me any sin that I may have that he has discovered that I am unaware of, so that I may repent of it before it leads me into the same kind of wickedness that I see in these men that I stand in opposition to. After all, how did they get there? They started out with a sin and more sin and more sin, and it grows, right? They just start out hating God, you know, at this level of intensity. And so we need to beware that the great sins we see in others, all of those sins are incipiently in us. The seeds are there. And so as we stand outraged at how wicked people have assaulted God, we need to then ask God, God, show me if any of that's in me. And Lord, if it is, show it to me so that I can repent of it, so I can be delivered from it, so I can stay in the pathway of everlasting life and not wind up where those people wound up. And so the psalmist's goal is to be led into everlasting life, verse 24. And that should be our goal and our great concern as well. We must never be at peace with the haters and the blasphemers of God and act like, oh well. But we must also beware of becoming like them ourselves. You know, in fighting evil, you can become evil. And you don't want to do that. And that's what he's praying against here. We need the preservation of God in the midst of spiritual warfare as we stand up for God, because it is all too easy for us to resort to carnal weapons, unauthorized weapons, in our warfare against the wicked who oppose God. I mean, you know, we hear all about ISIS, right, and the way they machine gun folks down. Ever been tempted to get a machine gun and go back and give them some of their own medicine? Well, I have. And I think, no, I can't do that. I've got to pray. And I've got to use spiritual weapons, the Word of God and prayer, legitimate things, not ungodly things. And so we have to check in our own spirits the desire to use wicked methods to fight wicked people. And ask God to show us if we're doing that, and ask God to deliver us from that. Well, as we think about the omniscience of God, what a comfort it is to know God fully understands, he fully knows, and to know that this God is always with us. And this God who knows everything about us and who is constantly with us has infinite power to deploy on our behalf to help us to accomplish all the purposes for which he created and designed us to achieve. And as we stand with him and for him, he then protects us spiritually so we don't fall into the sins of those who come under the wrath of God. And this God who is all-knowing and all-present and all-powerful is the God who has said, I will lead you in the paths of everlasting life. Just humble yourself to believe in me, to follow me and serve me, and I will lead you straight into heaven. And so it's a wonderful psalm in which it brings God into the most intimate sphere of human aspiration and human experience and human existence. And it demonstrates to us what it means to have an experiential walk with God, where there is this communion with God and his knowledge of us. There's this communion with God in his presence with us. And there is this communion with God in his power in us. And there's this communion with God regarding issues of justice in the world. Here is a man who walks and talks with God. And this is what real spirituality looks like. It isn't waving your hands in the air and speaking in tongues. May God help us to be like this man who walked with the infinite God. Shall we pray together? Our Father, we thank you for the fact that you are instantly near, that we have just to turn our thoughts to you and we are, as it were, face to face with you. Your hand is on us. Your presence is with us. Your knowledge of us is complete, and the power you exercise on our behalf is just amazing. Father, what a source of comfort and peace, what a freedom from anxiety and care that produces in our lives. Help us, Father, to live in the spirit and in the thoughts of Psalm 139. May we walk this walk and know this communion and fellowship with you each and every day. In Jesus' name we ask it. Amen.